So I went to your dentist last week. You know, I was looking for a new dentist and you recommended your family dentist.
Yeah.
He was great. Dr. Midget.
He's awesome.
He was great. Anyway, I mentioned that I knew you and the whole office like, Ace! and he said, yeah, I've been his dentist since he was like 11 years old. And I said, that's hard to imagine. Like, what's little Ace like? And he was like, let's be clear. He's never been little Ace. I'm Scott Wayne.
And I'm Ace Colwood.
Little Ace Colwood. And this is Envoy Recorded Radio.
We're home again, but we've been gone. We were up in Montana last week, which
we know, I we recorded one there. And yeah. We've had feedback that lots of people liked our Montana episode, but the main core of the feedback was it was shorter.
Oh.
So
thanks, y'all. Montana was fun because Perry and I doubled the population of black people there.
You did.
We did. And I wasn't allowed to say that in session, but I'm back on my home turf, and so I can say that now.
What is the demographic of African Americans in
Montana?
Well,
so that's the interesting thing. I looked up the demographic data, and it actually made sense. There are about 200 people in the room, and the black population is 0.58%. So representatively, only one of us was allowed to be there, so I kicked Perry out. It was great. Moving on.
Oregon has a history of ejecting black people. I don't think it was Montana.
It's a sundown state is not where we were. No. It was a really good time, though. And I got my snow in, much to the chagrin of the Richmonders who did not get snow this year.
All right, let's move to involuntary sponsor of the week. So I was out last night with the two co-founders of something called the Lost Office Collaborative. So Mark and Christian.
Have you found said office?
I couldn't find the office.
Okay,
but I found the bar where we were meeting. So plug for them. And really, this is it's a sympathy plug, because this is a firm that is really embracing like working out the future of work.
Yeah.
And I have no answers. And so I just, out of respect for people who are willing to like lean in, and they've built this amazing sort of retreat space lab of like what the future of the office might look
into. It's
an integrated like sort of designer space with technology. Anyway, you can look it up at lostoffice.co and reach out to Mark or Christian if you're interested in it. But really, it was just out of respect for them trying to untangle what seems to me like the Gordian knot of what people want to do at work and how they work and all those things. So take a look at it, Lost Office Collaborative. And I was going to say we never get paid for these things, but I think one of them might have bought drinks last night. So maybe this was a paid place. I don't know.
It was a bribe is how that works. Okay, the Zeitgeist. Yeah, there's a lot going on right now. I'm like looking at the list of things that we might touch on, and we won't cover all of them.
So let's go to France. Perry, ooh. Perry, come up with some oui. Stereotypical like French sting.
Lights jetant.
Ah, le sting. Oui. So... So in response, well, it's said it's in response to the overturning of Roe v. Wade in the United States, France actually voted last week to introduce a constitutional amendment to protect abortion rights for women.
So it is enshrined in the Constitution.
And it was a very clean vote. Like it made it there. So it's interesting, you know, how these issues rebound from country to country, because I don't think there was a question in France that it was at risk, but parliamentarians started pushing it through in response to the US judgment.
Yeah.
And that's not for me to express necessarily an opinion about this, more an observation around these issues are now so integrated through digital communications that one issue is leapfrogging other countries. Mm-hmm. There's that sort of very direct connective tissue. So interesting news from France. And then
related to how things leapfrog literally across oceans now, given technology, like I feel like we're in this tension of entrenching into nationalism. And we see that as a global trend. And like the we talked about Banny, like the fragile, brittle world that we live in. The assumption of globalization is a thing that we talk about. And on one hand, we are trying to be more local, etc. And at the same time, we see major constitutional issues being leapfrogged because we're hyper-connected. And I think both can be true, but like wrapping our head on what's what, like what's a global issue, what's a local issue, I'm finding fascinating to watch us wade through societally.
Yeah, I agree. I think there's a tension between like go local, go local. We should decide things. This concept we talk about around subsidiarity,
mm-hmm.
making decisions at the lowest possible level, runs counter to like, hey, global human rights and global society and global connection. And I actually feel that the global thing is on the wane and we're in a trajectory mm-hmm. towards more localization. And we might be entering one of those periods of sort of retrenchment, which economists hate because it doesn't support the GDP growth. You know, generally, globalization, free markets result in everybody getting a little bit richer or less poor. I do think there's a more nuanced argument than the numbers, though, which is, does it change the quality of life by having local goods and you know, things made and created and purchased locally?
GDP versus the GDP conversation. I don't remember who this was. Gross domestic happiness.
It was the Tibetans.
That's right.
I think it might Tibetans or Nepalese. Was gross domestic happiness.
Yeah, so how the idea of like measuring the success of a society via GDP. No, Lucy was just talking about this. She was talking about the Tibetans, but Lucy put words to this. I saw it on a slide. I got to like, when's the last time you saw Lucy do her thing? From our team. You know who Lucy is.
Talks to her every day.
I sat in on one of her sessions. Like I wasn't in the session, I wasn't working. She's very good. But she was talking about like measuring society by GDP is how we've done it for forever, but like are people happy? So is that localization trend about making more money or is it about
just like being gross firm happiness?
Yeah, no, I dig it. I dig it. Let's switch gears to AI. And we've got a couple pieces here I kind of want to introduce via litigation in the American court system. Elon Musk has sued OpenAI for choosing profits over the benefits of humanity. And so this saga continues. The nonprofit that is nestled under a for-profit or vice mm-hmm. versa is now being sued by one of the people who helped start it but is no longer involved. And OpenAI is basically saying Elon's jealous that he's not benefiting from the success of OpenAI. And for as contentious as Elon has been and insufferable more often than not, I think the idea that like, yeah, are we pushing too quickly on a thing when we could be corroborating and helping design regulation and guardrails and, you know, be intentional about growth, I think calling and checking that thing is probably valuable from Elon's perspective.
Yeah, so as much as it pains me to agree with him, and I don't disagree that he might be jealous, this was set up. Sam Altman raised the money from Elon Musk to set up OpenAI as a nonprofit, had a nonprofit structure, and then in the debacle a few months ago, the way they fixed the problem was to remove the two women from the board, replace them with two white men. You may recall this time, Larry Summers being one of them,
mm-hmm.
Essentially made it a for-profit model. It's still technically like under the structure, but with enough lawyers, you can manipulate it.
Elon's people's argument is he helped start it, he helped fund it, and it was under the auspice that it would remain dedicated to creating safe, open source AGI for public benefit. And like,
so yeah, and look, I think Microsoft's done a great job over the past few years. Also, I'll be calling Microsoft for a favor next week, so I want to say nice things. But like, as one of their largest investors, if not the largest investor, yeah, it's all just a little murky.
Yeah,
it's a little murky. It's always an uncomfortable place when I'm agreeing with Elon Musk.
Yeah, well, here we are.
As we're talking about AI,
Perry
pointed out a new career path to me the other day.
Is Perry leaving us?
Perry
resigned last week, happened.
It's all about intonation, because I heard him say, I found a new career path. And I was like, that's very interesting. Tell me about this new job. But what he was probably saying is, I found a new career path.
A new career path.
Perry is going off to be an AI prompt engineer. And I'd never heard this before.
No?
Have you heard of this?
No, I don't.
So Perry, what is an AI prompt engineer?
So basically, AI prompt engineering is kind of like the science and the kind of accumulation of everything you know about creating a specific prompt to get AI to do what you want it to do, but engineering the words and the phrasing in each prompt and in that order to get a desired outcome or to optimize the outcome.
So if you were trying to brief AI video creation, it's that you're using a form of words that's the most efficient for the AI generation to take place.
Yeah, it's essentially process of elimination. How do you whittle down a series of words in which order to get the optimized outcome out of generative AI?
So I use Perplexity as my AI thing.
Oh, yeah.
And my interactions look like, no, Perplexity, I didn't mean that. Oh, shit. Ah, God, no, not that. And yeah, so
it took me a second. I thought you were just saying Perplexity is like, I confuse my AI all the time. I didn't realize you were talking about a platform.
Well, maybe that's what it's just Perplexity.
I say things like a Brit and it doesn't understand.
I like Perplexity. The reason I like it, this isn't a plug, but Sam put me onto this, Sam Wallace, is that it sources its references.
That's cool.
So it generates the output, but unlike some of the mainstream ChatGPT, it tells you where it's coming from, so you can duck into it.
So AI prompt engineering, copywriting, and kind of design for getting AI to do what we want.
Hey, it was great knowing you, Barry, and I wish you well with your future career.
Yeah, thanks. Fun, man. See you guys in the future.
Well, touche. Hey, another piece, it's like weirder. AI is stemming child abuse porn.
What?
Yeah, like, so past 2 years, Pornhub, we've talked about porn, like pushing technology forward, and how the industry, the valley, does that. So Pornhub has basically piloted an AI tool.
Not Silicon Valley, San Fernando Valley, the valley in LA.
Different valley, Well, Pornhub has, their UK website has piloted the use of AI to stem or put up a warning message when folks are looking for illegal content, particularly that around child abuse. And instead, the chatbot is it's identifying words or phrases linked to abuse and then is pointing people to seek help instead. And so on one hand, like an incredible use of AI to stop some pretty harmful and illegal behavior. The like really uncomfortable side is the words or phrases have been searched 4.4 million times.
What?
In the past 2 years. Yeah. 4.4.
That's out of a population of 60 million people.
4.4 million queries.
65 million people.
Over the last, over the last 2 years, looking for the type of abuse we're talking about, but also finding a chatbot and a way to stem that behavior, point people towards resources. It's one of those awful things in society that technology might help a little bit with.
You know,
cool.
I was thinking about, there is a debate over issues like this of whether it's a mental illness, like how do you punish or do you treat? I'm just thinking about my dad here. My dad would be like, well, I've got a better system, so the AI picks it up, and then when you do that it says hit the return key, and you hit the return key and it's electrified and it blows your arm off. And would be like my dad's view
old
of that.
Oil riggers. Yeah, like, right. Path to solve this problem.
And then we bring out the guillotine and that's how we deal with this stuff.
All right, you've got a note about world class.
Oh yeah, this is coming up. And if you're a client, you're gonna think we're talking about you, but we're not. This is coming up a lot, so don't call me about this. But I'm saying this word. I use this word a lot. This term, world class, a lot, and it's coming up a lot. And people talking about world class and all of those things. And I just think like I wanted to share what I think world class is. It's twofold. First of all, it's what it says on the tin. Like you're in the top flight that you can find anywhere in the world. So if I'm a world-class negotiator, I've got to be in that top 1-2% of people, talent, or you as a mediator, anywhere, whether it's in Hong Kong, Sao Paulo, New York, Paris, like that's what it means. Like you've really got to be at the top of your game. By the way, I'm not saying that either of us are in that category, but if we were, but what I also think it means is we get to be in the room with people who are really at the top of their game. And here's my observation. is when you're very good at something, you think you have all the answers, right? You think you're the expert and you spend a lot of time telling people what they should do. But the people who are really great, it's like they've reached a point where they realize they have so much more to learn and they just want to learn from other disciplines. Like, it's not that they have my, they realize that actually mastery of their discipline involves learning from lots of other disciplines. So if you're a, if you're a genius around biology, you start learning from chemistry or anthropology. Yeah. That's it. But you don't just go, oh, I know everything there is to know about biology. And that's, I don't know why I'm talking about this. It's just sort of coming up with bandying the word around a little lightly. When people say the world class, they mean I'm the best in the company or the best in the city. But also just that pushing through to being like really great is realizing you've got lots to learn from other areas, yeah, not just your own.
Can I add, yes, and on the learning front, because I had a conversation pretty recently with a good buddy who's like maybe thinking about the next career and figuring out what he goes to do. And I was kind of breaking down a framework I used as I was winding down a tech company and saying, what do I want? And one of the buckets on my Venn diagram was simply, what do I want to learn professionally? And very quickly, I dropped the professionally piece. It was just, what do I want to learn? And it was, I think in that same vein, without knowing it, it was like a subconscious, like, I just get some time to play. What should I go play with? And it was the time I bought my first motorcycle. And two things came out of that that I would not have known if I had focused professionally. I'd be a more competent designer. I push pixels pretty well. I'd have like gotten into Illustrator and played there. But instead, what I found is that when I'm wrenching on the bike, irrespective of whether it actually runs, it is the only time things in my head, me ace, it's the only time things are quiet, like just working on the bike or with a wrench in my hand. And the second is, for all of the work we do with humans and we say they're irrational, and for all of the work with machines that we expect are logical, I find that machines and humans function very similarly when we're looking at the organization level. And I would not have gone there to explore that to better understand and inform my work now, had I like focused on the what do I need to learn professionally as much as can I go out into the world and just learn a little bit. It has informed what I do, how I do it, and how I stay sane on top of all of that. And I would have missed that otherwise. So I'm a yes and to the
That's
learning.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
That's beautiful. I mean, until you reference whether you're good at it or not, I mean, just as evidence of whether you're good at it or not, we do have motorcycles around here. None of them are yours. They haven't made it here. So just like, they
Perry,
don't really go.
Perry rode his motorcycle yesterday, and it's because I did not work on it.
He swept in, and I didn't see you as he swept in on his motorcycle, but I could imagine your face as he swept in on his motorcycle that moves.
I think the last time Perry's motorcycle had issues was immediately after I rode it.
Yeah, that's exactly what happened.
I'm sorry, Perry.
All right, let's move on to Envoy Tank Radio.
The French being the French.
So I get to bash the French and the Germans this week, is just every British person's dream. So the war in Ukraine, France is causing all kinds of wild trouble, throwing out the questions. President Macron is being thrown out the question of whether, this is such a mess, whether NATO members should actually not quite join the front lines, but be in Ukraine behind the lines running support positions while the Ukrainians fight. Mm. And it's really upset the other NATO members. To quote Politico, the France's chief of the defense staff had written to half of his NATO colleagues, which I presume were the big countries, seeing if there was a possibility of coalition willing to take over certain tasks from Ukraine, including manning defensive systems, launching cyber operations, and helping in demining. And then it says, every ally I'm told reacted with a furious, what the fuck? Seeing a sneaky political end run around them, and they made that clear their answer was an emphatic no. So that was that. And then what I wanted to call out is, for all the French posturing, and I get the idea, but I mean, talk about escalation. But they're not delivering. Like, Germany has delivered €17 billion in military aid, and the French have delivered two, like, and have a bigger military than Germany. Like, just that, like, words and actions. So that was my call out to the French. But then things got worse. So after other NATO allies said, absolutely not, we wouldn't have people behind the lines helping in this area, the head of the Luftwaffe, the German Air Force, was on a call with other military chiefs from Singapore on an open line. It was a WebEx call, and it was intercepted by the Russians. Do you know how it was intercepted? They just joined the call, like you or I did. Nobody noticed. Think of all those Teams calls on which they were quoted as referring to, if they were going to bring in Taurus missiles, which are these German-built long-distance missiles that the Ukrainians are desperate for, was that the way that they'd be able to support the missiles would be to use the Brits and the French, who are already behind the scenes in Ukraine helping with targeting. Basically the very thing that the French had been publicly lobbying for as well. So to say it was a bit of a cluster amongst NATO last week is a bit of an understatement.
Yeah, okay.
But this is where military and diplomacy comes, like, side by side. And, yeah. But I do love the hacking of the WebEx call by pressing join
hacking,
call here.
Just join call here. Input name, not Russian. That's it. They won't know. How will they know?
Sven. They'll Let's go with Sven. Know. Nobody questions Sven.
Is Sven the go-to?
It is for me.
It's Sean, which is very similar.
Oh, I just
say Sean is Sean. The American. Yeah, so we used to, like, back in the day when I was a delinquent, and we used to, like, sneak into parties. People would ask, like, who we knew there, and we'd just say Sean. There's a Sean at every party.
The girls the other day were asking why they have blonde hair and nobody in the family has blonde hair, and I was like, you might ask your mom about Sven. They're dying laughing.
Sven is the European equivalent.
And anyway,
we
have different moms. I was like, I know, it's really messed up, isn't it?
Sven. Touche. All right. Tools for tools.
Okay, this is a dumb tool this week.
Does this count? Yeah, I think it counts.
Yeah.
All right.
So look, we're gonna be talking in a few weeks about this new social connection initiative that we're launching very soon. But as part of this, I started a thing. It was really a selfish thing a few weeks ago, which I referred to because I hate organizing things and we spend our whole lives like scheduling stuff. Yeah. I called it the non-obligatory running club.
Yeah.
And I emailed a few people and said, these are the firm rules. The rules are, I send out an email and it says the time that the run starts. The rule is we do not have to run together. The rule is we don't have to run the same distance. We just start at the same place. And then I'll choose a coffee shop nearby for us to go if you want to. But you do not RSVP. For the love of God, do not RSVP. Don't say you're going. Don't say you're not going. Show up if you want to go. And it's been great. And there's just been a few people showed up.
Yeah.
And I love it. But I thought of it as a tool because we have this pressure, right? It goes in your calendar. You do things. There's not many things left where it's like, it's totally okay. It reminds me of like a Domino's game, right?
Yeah.
If you're there, you're there. Like, do it. And I'm really enjoying it. So I encourage people to start your own non-obligatory running club.
Two things. One, look, I hate running, but add me to this.
Oh, shit. I just realized
that
I didn't invite you.
No, you did.
Did I?
You did invite me. You invited me. I didn't respond. You busted my balls for not responding.
Oh, I did.
And now we're here with you not remembering that you invited me and busted my chops about it. Add me to the stupid list. And given that there's no pressure, there's no pressure.
There is no pressure.
Anyway, let's see how it clouds. So I got to go to my alma mater yesterday and give a keynote for the professional development conference, which I thought was a lot of fun. The staff senate and HR put on a university-wide conference for professional development. A lot of familiar faces, got to hang out, said hey, gave some hugs, but got to talk about allyship and how we start building like the frameworks and the culture and behavior for us to connect better. And I did one of the questions that I ask pretty regularly, which is, hey, women, if you had 24 hours without men, what would you do differently? What would change for you? And it's always a blend of answers. Some people are like, nothing would change. Some people are like, my honey-do list wouldn't get done. Some people are like, I'd be able to, you know, run with headphones in and, not wear a bra is one that comes up pretty regularly. Like I read that one out and everybody just laughed. I was like, that's the only answer. We had a really good time.
But also a serious answer as well.
Yeah, legit. Yeah. One of the responses was, this is too political.
What?
And I, because the point is we talk about invisible frameworks in this. Like, if you're in an in-group or in a position of power, you aren't subjected to the things that the out-group is. And so for men, the at least societally, what is perceived as the dominant group, if we're not aware of the thing. So I made the case that we travel all the time. We're always in hotels. The polite thing to do is to let a woman off of the elevator before me. But the practical thing, if I'm aware of an invisible framework, is to get off the elevator first so she doesn't feel
you
like I'm behind her
down
walking down to her hotel room. Okay. Right? Yeah. And so, like, knowing that I'm 6'4", 315 pounds, I should cross the street at night if somebody's... I'm actually, I just hit 300.
Non-obligated running club.
I'm going down.
Oh, that's good.
I just hit 300 today. Yeah, thanks. So, this is too political is one of the responses. And because it's yelling at clouds, I don't have to be particularly nice here. First, that's bullshit. Second, per Pew Research, in 2022, American women typically earn 82 cents for every dollar earned by men. So 18-cent gender pay gap, but down from 35-cent gender pay gap in 1982. So, you know, a couple decades later, we have made a tiny bit of progress, but still, women, your work is not as valuable as mine. I don't know what to tell you. I'm sorry not to get political. 90% of people who commit violent physical assault are men. Men perpetuate 95% of all serious domestic violence. Department of Justice estimates that 95% of reported assaults on spouses or ex-spouses are committed by men against women. How the fuck is this a political conversation? Is my actual question. That is ridiculous. And that is actually why I do the work I do. Because somebody in the room thinks I'm having a political conversation when my sisters and my mom and your daughters don't get to exist in the world the same way I do. I don't understand how this could possibly be political as much as, I don't know, just being a fucking human being for a second. And like, I'm fired up right now, but this is where we live. And oh, it is infuriating.
Do you think that was a desire to close it down?
I think it was a desire to express discomfort with the reality of some people's worlds.
Does your gut tell you, because these are anonymous, but does your gut tell you that it was a man or a woman that wrote that?
My gut actually says it was a woman. Yeah, there's along political, actual political lines, because society is governed often by politics right now. It said, hey, this doesn't matter for me. But if I had to guess, it was a white woman who felt it was political. And there's deeper underlying pieces there about self-interest and what that means.
So we don't know, but you felt that was the place.
Yeah.
You see that. Yeah. Can I suggest an additional question sometime or mix it up?
Yeah.
I'm always intrigued as to what the world might look like if you used fingerprint recognition, that firearms would only work if the fingerprint hit, right? Which you could do. If we chose to do that, you could do that. Or facial recognition. But that you could only purchase guns if you're a woman. Only women had the right to bear arms. I think that's a really interesting concept.
Yeah.
Like, what would the world look like? Because it's a rebalancing of... I'm intrigued.
Yeah. All right. I'm done yelling. I'm good. Where are we going next? Where are you going to be? I'm going to be in Chaco Bottom.
That's on your travel list? That's 4 miles from here.
So I was going to be in Toronto at one point, and I was going to be in Mexico City, and I've decided that I'm not going to either of those places. Sorry, Perry, we're not going to those places, but we will be going to Chaco Bottom to run a workshop, and I think that's an even trade.
Well, I can confirm after that you are going to Columbia, South Carolina with me. And then after that, I'm going somewhere that I can't disclose. I'll tell you about it next week.
Oh.
It's a secret trip.
I want to know now. It's
undercover.
Fine. All right.
Undercover.
All right. Let's get out of here. Hey, it was just International Women's Day.
Yeah. And just to call this out, I wrote this.
Yeah.
So when you were talking about women's rights earlier, it was not actually a token gesture around International Women's Day because you didn't know I'd written this until you just read it.
No, correct.
Yeah. So as we close out the episode, maybe we celebrate the women we get to work with and for every single day. Mm. So here at Envoy, Angela, Jana, Jamie, Lucy, Sandra, and some woman named Vera or V, vaguely recognizable. And then over at our sister company, Paddleboard Ventures, Claire, Rashida, Sarah, and of course, the boss, Stinson.
I'm Ace Caldwell.
And I'm Scott Wayne.
We'll see you next time.
If Stinson approves it.